I'm Dr. Noah Emery.
I'm Sam Acuff.
And this is the Addiction Psychologist Podcast, brought to you by the Society of Addiction Psychology.
Hey everyone, today we're going to be talking with Dr. Alan Budney. Alan is a professor of psychiatry in the Geisel School of Medicine at Dartmouth College. He is also the director of Dartmouth's T32 program. And today we're going to be talking about the effects of cannabis legalization.
Alan, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
All right. Well, we like to start off each episode by having our guests tell us a little bit about their training history. So I was wondering if you could just walk us through that a little bit.
And you want me to go back to elementary school?
As far back as you're really willing to go, whatever makes you feel comfortable. This is your world.
I'm going to skip high school because that was the wrong kind of training.
Gotcha.
Go right to undergraduate. I got a bachelor's degree in psychology, clinical psychology at Penn State University. Got me interested in, you know, psychopathology, et cetera. And I knew at the end of that year I wanted to go to graduate school in clinical psychology. And go get a PhD. I didn't know I wanted to be a researcher. I just knew I was very interested in it. And if you got a bachelor's degree, it wasn't much you could do with it unless you went on to graduate school. And so 2 years later, I got accepted at Rutgers and got my PhD at Rutgers. When I first got to Rutgers, I was my research was in sports psychology. With a very interesting professor, and I loved what I was doing. I'm very much a sports person, but about halfway through, I figured I don't really know what type of job I would get with that. And so I thought, oh, well, drugs and sports, that's kind of a course sometimes people teach. And so I went into an independent readings course with Barbara McCrady, a former Division 50 president, I think. Mm-hmm. So I went to ask Barbara to teach me about addiction, and I did a independent reading in the summer, and that just got me started in this field. Barbara basically gave me such a great perspective on addiction and what the field's about and how different things put together and how behaviorist thought and how traditional disease model people thought. And anyway, I was on my way and kind of really, really enjoyed that. And my dissertation was still in sports psychology, but most of my clinical training and research training came in addiction with Barbara, and alcohol in particular. And after that, I got a postdoctoral fellowship up in Vermont with Steve Higgins, who, if you don't all know, he's a former Division 28 president. But Steve is a premier researcher originally in the field of cocaine dependence, behavioral treatment development, kind of one of the founders of practical CM treatments, contingency management for cocaine. So I trained with Steve on cocaine. We ran some seminal studies, got great results with these behavioral treatments for people that were struggling with cocaine dependence. And then it was time, all right, you're finishing up your postdoc. Now what are you going to do? And I'd like to stay in Vermont because Vermont was a great place to live, and my wife had a job there as well. She was on the faculty, and I said, guys, I'd like to stay, and I needed to find my own independent path, and nobody was studying marijuana or cannabis up in Vermont. We had John Hughes studying nicotine, Warren Bickle doing opiates, John Helzer doing alcohol, and Steve Higgins doing cocaine, and so I thought, well, marijuana. And a lot of the research we did with the cocaine patients, they were all marijuana users. And they didn't really want to give up marijuana. They were ready to give up cocaine, and they focused hard on that, but they wanted to keep using marijuana. Same with the patients in the opiate clinic. And so I had done a few secondary analyses of the marijuana versus non-marijuana users and stuff during my postdoctoral training, and got some kind of fascinating results. And so I was really primed to move into the marijuana field. And so they let me stay, and I was on my way. Wrote a couple grants, got them funded, and spent 15 years or so as a professor in Vermont.
Wow. Well, that sounds like an amazing group of professors up there. That's, you know, they've influenced a lot of the field.
it was definitely a blessing to fall into that place and learn from Steve and John and Warren, all leaders of the field, all really good critical thinkers.
Right.
Also good grant writers. Help you learn how to write a good grant. And if you really want to do a lot of research, you got to get the grant. So.
Right, right. And of course, you have one of the best names, last names for someone who's studying marijuana. So
that's good. I hadn't heard that for a little while, but yes, Bud for Budney. So it fits right in there.
Right, right. Well, we wanted to reach out to you because you are one of the sort of preeminent scholars in this area. And, you know, I think it was in early December, the House of Representatives passed the Marijuana Opportunity Reinvestment and Expungement Act of, it started in 2019 and it finally was passed in the House in 2020. And it's probably not going to go anywhere in the Senate. It may have already been shot down. But it got us thinking a lot about the possibility of this happening. You know, we've had a lot of decriminalization and legalization across the states. Canada had recently decriminalized and I think legalized as well. And really, there's a trend across the world doing this, and it kind of feels like it's coming. It's going to happen at some point. And what we wanted was just to hear from you, an expert in this field. You know, what this is going to be like if it does happen? What's the potential impact of cannabis legislation?
Yeah, well, that's a good question, a very important question. To some degree, it depends what that legislation eventually looks like.
Yeah.
So, you know, they could have all kinds of things that they say are okay to have, okay not to have, and lots of stipulations. But generally, I guess there's a couple major things that are important about the feds legalizing cannabis. One, and probably one of the more important ones, is that all of a sudden that opens up the banking industry to not be subject to legal consequences if they're funding cannabis dispensaries, cannabis sales, et cetera, in different states. Right now, you know, banks can't get involved because it's still a federal offense, and so you can't have cross-state commodities. And so banks haven't been really funding and been willing to invest in the cannabis industry yet. And, you know, like other drugs that are legal, tobacco and alcohol, I guess we could maybe put caffeine in there, but we'll just go with alcohol and tobacco. You know, it's the industry drives the market and drives problems, can create problems, controls availability, controls products, et cetera. So the feds unleashing that will change the nature of the game for big industry's involvement in the cannabis field. And people have been writing about that, have been worried about that for a while, because as we know, big industry is out there to make money. As our little industry, everybody's out to make money.
So that's not industry. Like
the small ones are not. So, but people are out to make money. But when you have big dollars behind it, they have lots of power in research and development to figure out how to make the best products that people will buy. And when you're talking about drugs, including cannabis, just like alcohol and nicotine, you're trying to find the way to deliver as much of the drug that people like. And if you can make it more likable, desirable, they do more of it. And for those that are clinical psychologists or treatment providers, we know that people develop problems. Some people can develop problems. And if you make these products more dangerous, more potentially addictive, more attractive, cheaper, marketing strategies to, you know, make them more attractive to certain subgroups that are vulnerable, that becomes even more of a problem than it is now. It already is a problem a little bit, but once the, you know, you put the big industry, big pharma in, you have to start to worry about that. So that's probably one of the bigger concerns. The next is just, it depends on how it, there's some good consequences possibly, and that it may help change, the criminalization. Obviously it will change the criminalization, but, you know, I guess states would all have to adopt this. Again, it depends how it's written, but you know, you don't want people going to jail for possession and, you know, use and all those things, especially when it's done, with prejudice towards vulnerable populations and minorities. And that's certainly why the one of the big pushes for federal legalization has been to stop the, you know, the jailing of young black men and young Hispanics, young black men in particular, with, you know, with the strategies have been used. So there's been lots of talk about that. And so that's obviously an important positive that could come of it. The other important positive that perhaps could come of it is that researchers like myself and those that are really trying to understand cannabis and cannabinoids, and whether or not there's benefits to it or formulations that are safer for recreational use, whatever, all the different things you can do with the cannabis cannabinoid compounds, it'll make it much more available for researchers. So right now it's still a Schedule I drug. If they deschedule it or move it down in the schedule, in the Controlled Substance Act scheduling process, then researchers will be much more ready to take on cannabis-type research. Mm-hmm. Right now it's such a pain to go through all the DEA hoops and that you have to get to do the research. And so we need more research, both for the potential medical benefits, which who knows what we'll find there, but to know more about the hazards of some of these products that are on the market now.
So it sounds like, you know, the legalization in certain states might not really be a good model to understand fully what would happen, in part because of the federal implications for banks. It could be a lot different if it was legalized on the federal level.
It will change things at all the state levels, yes.
Yeah.
For those reasons. And the states are so different in the way they've legalized or decriminalized, et cetera. Comparing one state to another, you have to get in there and really look at what all the stipulations and regulations, what the law really looks like, to feel like, is that a good way to do it or a bad way to do it? I don't think any of them have done it very well. By and large, you know, until they get to the point of completely legalizing it and starting to make real regulations about product and product control, it's hard to argue that it's, you know, a good thing at the moment.
Yeah, and that's the interesting thing, right? If we'd use some of the COVID state-by-state kind of regulations as a model, having all of these different kind of patchwork, different policies really make it difficult to kind of articulate the individual impacts that it's going to have on communities and things like this. And then I think that makes it pretty tough. Like I even think of it, so I'm in Colorado now, right? And we probably have a pretty liberal cannabis legislation here. And we can do some pretty interesting research with cannabis, but even that is still pretty murky. And like, we don't even understand it that well as researchers who are on the ground here. And so I think your point is well taken, both from a industry standpoint and in a research industry standpoint in that way, and that like really trying to figure it out, it's going to be tough.
Right. And so, you know, once if the federal government legalizes it, again, depending what that looks like, then hopefully, I guess it means if those same products are still available, the high potency concentrates and the things we know very little about because we've never brought them into the laboratory, perhaps that facilitates that. Like right now, even though in Colorado it's legal, your NIH or NIDA researchers can't go out and purchase that and bring it into their laboratory. They can come up with some creative procedures to do it in the wild, which some of them have done, some really cool stuff. But right now, researchers can't even buy the products that are legal in your state and study them, because if they're studying them using federal dollars, that's going to get them in trouble.
No, you can't do any of that stuff. Luckily, there's in Colorado, at least there's a state agency that now has funding for this specifically that allows some of that to be a little bit easier, to just the dollars, but we still can't, like, we can't buy cannabis products and, you know, give them to participants. We have to have them like get it. And then like we're doing stuff right now at CSU, at least with like a mobile lab,
right?
Where like we drive up in a van basically at like to their crib and like go use and then come out here and then like we're gonna do some stuff.
Right, that's what I was referring to. And
yeah, we do that. Some stuff like that, or like there's been other really cool stuff from people like Mark Prince and Brad Connor, who will like go to these like places that are like cannabis bars basically,
yeah,
and see what people do out there in the wild and stuff like that. And so you can get creative, but that really restricts our ability to understand like the pharmacology of it, and a lot of different behavioral correlates of intoxication and long-term consequences, positive or negative, on an individual's biology, psychology, and so forth. And so I think cannabis legislation at the federal level will at least unlock some of that stuff,
right?
It sounds like.
Yeah, well, and you know, researchers having to go do stuff like that, like, it sounds sketchy, right? And that's that's part of what, you know, it being an illegal substance, a Schedule I substance,
that's
you know.
That's a good point.
It makes people, I guess what I'm thinking of is, you know, when we think of harm, like the harm of a drug like cannabis, you know, the criminalization of it makes the harm go up, because often in harm we incorporate, like in David Nutt's definitions of harm, we incorporate the legal implications of the drug use. And so when we remove that, and start to remove stigma, if that's possible, what is going to be the impact, good or bad, on, I guess, the total harm that the drug has on society, on that cannabis?
Yeah,
has?
Well, that, so you just introduced a very nice broad definition of harm that includes the legal consequences, which in a sense it should. But if you remove that, I mean, it is fascinating. I think this is where people are very poorly informed generally, including scientists and policymakers, is in a sense the question you're asking on, which is how addictive is our cannabis products, and if you are addicted to them, what are the things that happen to you? And you know, there's a good bit of work out there, and my research has always been on people that have problems with cannabis that need to stop. Sometimes it was for legal reasons. But rarely is it ever that it's legal reasons and their lives are great other than they got busted. You know, right. They're just like your alcohol patient, your cocaine patient, et cetera. Some people get into it where that's all they're focused on. And they're ignoring, they're, you know, getting in trouble with their job. They're not completing family assignments. You know, they're not there socially for their family or their friends. And, you know, the drug takes over a good bit of their part of their life. And that happens with cannabis, you know, just like the other drugs. And the range of problems you see with cannabis users, the people that they develop, are from mild. There are some that, you know, they do smoke a little too much and develop a bad cough and their wife nags them, but that's about it.
Yeah.
But it's enough and that, you know, they're missing some kids things once in a while. And then there's people again that's all they're doing. They're getting up in the morning, they're getting high, not just, you know, taking a little token. They're not trying to get a job, and, you know, they're pretty much just living marginal lives, and cannabis is contributing to that. And some people say, well, that's just the nature of the person. Well, that's the case with, again, all drugs, with alcohol. Alcohol doesn't, I mean, the person's, people that get in trouble with alcohol, it's the same.
Yeah.
Diverse constellation of symptoms from mild to severe, and it's not like alcohol is this bad drug that makes them that way, but it's an interaction with the individual. Some people are more vulnerable than others, but the drugs do have the ability to start to, you know, slowly take over your life.
Yeah,
they're positive reinforcers, they're negative reinforcers, and so all the effects you get from them, generally people like. And if you have some problems in your life, they take away the problems temporarily, negative reinforcements. So you're feeling depressed or anxious, cannabis is just like alcohol or cocaine. When you do the drug, you know, you go into your own world for a little bit and you forget about those.
You feel good.
Yeah, and so who doesn't like that? And so if you're having a miserable time in your life, you get an escape temporarily. And so you develop a cannabis use disorder, which again looks fairly similar to the other use disorders. And so with changes to what's available, more freedom for cannabis products to be developed, more access, lower costs, all the things that kind of go on probably with legalization, you know, it's hard to imagine you're not going to increase problems at least a little bit.
Right.
Because again, all those are factors that things that factor into the development of problem drug use or substance use. And they will all be in favor of encouraging more use. And, you know, again, it'll still be a small percentage that develop problems, but probably will go up some. The data seem to point towards that. It's hard to make sense of all the epidemiological data right now, but generally, we don't see anything going down. Mostly we see things, if there is anything in the data, things getting going up. So you worry that, you know, will kids start earlier? Because now they're making products that are available like candy. And rather than have to smoke a bong with smoke, you can now start your cannabis career with a candy bar.
A brownie or something, yeah.
Yeah, and if you think about our society now, we've taught kids all about smoke is bad, right? The tobacco smoking's gone way down. Smoking's just bad. Kids kind of almost overreact. Oh, they're smoking. What's wrong with them? But anyway, so you have like, but anyway, smoke is bad. So cannabis, before, most people just smoked it, right? And so it would be one of those things, smoking is kind of disgusting. I'm not going to get into it. But now it's like, try this candy bar, this gummy, or, you know, there's alternative ways to do it. Some cool vaping device. So, and again, the data have yet to bear that out as far as I know. Again, I'm not completely on top of it, but it's hard to see that in the data yet. But as it becomes more commercialized, if you don't do things like have really good regulations, good prevention messaging, the legalization movement will move things in the wrong direction. So I think that's why if they're doing it, it is moving slowly. Hopefully it continues to move slowly, because the key to doing it with least amount of harm is good regulations.
Good regulation. Well, and it sounds pretty similar to vaping and e-cigarettes and how that's sort of developed and blew up. And
right.
In many ways, for a while, we're mostly targeting the younger populations.
Yeah, well, the other cool thing about, not about it's cool, but the interesting thing about this cannabis legalization, both medical and recreational, but is the people my age and a little bit younger. That's where the greatest increase in prevalence is happening. It's all the people that used to use a lot of marijuana in college or high school, and they stopped mostly. And now there's these new products. It's legal. You have such potent amounts, you basically don't really have to smoke a whole joint. You could vape a couple hits, you could do a gummy. And so it's attractive even for people in middle-aged or older, just like instead of drinking a glass of wine or having to smoke a beer, et cetera, they might go back and try that marijuana they tried before. Is that a bad thing? I'm not saying it's necessarily a bad thing. Maybe it's better than alcohol. I'm not sure, but it's certainly it's being tried now in that age group as well.
No, I think that makes a lot of sense, right? That it's the introduction of these new types of products have created a whole different level. They got like cannabis connoisseurs who are like, I'm going to try it all out and things like that. But also I think it introduces an interesting potential for benefit or harm about like the differences in the way that they deliver a high to a person, right? Like, like if you smoke cannabis, right? Like the onset of intoxication happens in seconds, right? Whereas if you eat cannabis, cannabis product with THC, at least in it, like a gummy or the lozenge, like you're talking about, has a totally different timeline,
right?
Like that can take 30, 45 minutes, maybe 60 minutes for it to onset. And unlike you know, combustible cannabis, or at least inhaled cannabis, is that like, you can't just be like, oh, that's good, I'm good right here. Right. Like you got to like take the whole thing and then say like, well, we'll see how this rolls. Right. And it's like, oh, that was too much.
Well, as you say that, it's kind of interesting. So in a sense, what you're saying is if you're going to do edibles, you have to have patience, right? You have to wait and see if, after you got experience, you would probably know how much is the time for you.
Right.
Experienced use. But you have to have patience. And people that do substances are, you know, again, overgeneralization, but they have less patience and less impulse control than people that tend not to do drugs and substances. So you're asking these people that are kind of risk takers to, you know, take this candy bar and then wait. But, you know, half an hour later, if nothing's happened yet, where are they and what are they doing? By then, yeah, maybe I'll have a beer while I wait. Or heck with that. Now I'm going to take a hit on a vape. I'm going to vape a little while. Wait for the. So, you know, there's all these things that can happen that you end up with a higher dose in your body, more intoxication than you wanted. Again, is that disastrous? Who knows? It depends on your experience level. But for the naive user, we all know now that it's been sort of disastrous. Lots of people have ended up in the hospital because they aren't patient or they, you know.
I think it's not working.
You're only supposed to take this little tiny piece of a candy bar, but who only eats a little tiny piece of a candy bar, right?
It's a candy bar. You eat the whole thing.
You eat the whole, right.
I wonder what, so I think there's some data out there that isn't always easy to make sense of. And I was wondering if a person that has like the long view like yourself, that I was wondering if you could help us make sense of it as it sits and then maybe what its potential would be with legalization, which is the connection between development of other mental disorders and the use of cannabis. And so I was wondering if you could just help us make sense of that a little bit. I know that's in the media a lot and stuff. And so I was wondering if maybe you could help us make sense of it a little bit.
Yeah, so that's a great question. It's a very broad question, unfortunately or fortunately. So, you know, there's certainly a lot of talk about what's the relationship between cannabis and psychosis or psychotic disorder, so severe mental illness. And there's a whole literature on that. It's growing. And so if you just start there and kind of compartmentalize that a little bit, that seems to be the way the field is setting itself up. But almost all the data on that topic is converging on the idea that cannabis can be a risk factor for the development of psychosis and perhaps schizophrenia. Now, that's a big, potentially dramatic statement. So whenever I say that, I say, well, hold on. That's true in a sense, but risk factor could mean anything, right? So when the public's trying to understand this, or even scientists, remember, risk factor means probabilities.
Right.
So what is the increased probability? If it's 20%, well, damn, that's, you know, you better worry about it. If it's 50%, yeah, don't get near that stuff. If it's 10%, I don't know. But what if it's like 1% or 0.5%, which is more like what the data are like? You know, there's an increased risk that this could happen to you, but it's not high. It's not like, you know, you do high potency cannabis, you're going to go psychotic and or develop schizophrenia. But when you do the research with enough people, the trend is, yes, it looks like it does increase your chances a little bit. And so that's important for people to know so they can take that into account. But what people tend to base their choices on when they think about probabilities, they know 1,000 people that get high and didn't get turned psychotic. And so that, although it may be true and there is an increased risk, it doesn't influence much as far as I can tell. It could influence policymakers, right? So some of the data that's coming out seems to suggest fairly strongly that that risk is mostly about use of higher potency cannabis and frequent use of the higher potency types of cannabis that are out there. And so your increased risk might really be much higher, it's still small, but it is higher if you're doing these high potency products. And so that's, and if you have prodromal syndrome, so you have some vulnerabilities we know towards psychosis, we know that you should stay away from cannabis. And for those folks, it can increase the probability of onset earlier and things like that. So there's an interesting literature there. The more broad question that people ask is more about depression and anxiety and does it, because people that use cannabis for, quote, medicinal reasons, the number 2 and 3 reasons they give are for depression and anxiety. But the literature does not support that in any way, shape, or form. You could argue there's some biological plausibility that, you know, what we know about how it works in the brain and where it works, that it can function that way. But when you do any of the longitudinal work that I've seen, you know, we don't see any sense that cannabis users are less depressed, or that it cannabis users that have clinical depression, their course of their disease or their disorder is better. It's usually worse. Mm-hmm. The same with anxiety. So that said, it's not that people don't use cannabis and say it's a good for their anxiety, and it's what they've used to moderate their anxiety for years and years and years. Those don't tend to be the people that went and got treatment for anxiety. So it's like, is that a function of some sub-threshold anxiety like a lot of us have that doesn't quite meet the clinical world, or the clinical thing? And we don't study that very well, right? We tend to study disorders. So, you know, it's again, getting back to what I said before, cannabis, like other drugs, if you have uncomfortable feelings or emotions or physical ailments, it takes most of that away temporarily. It distracts you from it. You think about something else. So both for depression and anxiety, it tends to do that. The literature, there really haven't been any great clinical trials of it, or even great laboratory studies using cannabis. And this kind of gets me on to the topic that I don't know if you want to take me to or not, but when we're talking cannabis and marijuana, what are we talking about? And so once you start talking about medical benefits, you start to bring in the needed discussion of what are we referring to? THC, the active drug that gets you high, part of cannabis products that get you high. We talk about any of the other compounds in the cannabis product, like CBD, the one that everybody's talking about, cannabidiol, which doesn't get you high. So you need to, if you're looking at the literature and trying to understand what people are telling you about they use cannabis, you do always want to say, well, tell me what you're using. And some people might say cannabis and all they're doing is pure CBD. There's no data that CBD helps with any of those disorders either. That said, we could use better research on that, but the data just do not support that at this point. Again, not that there's been a ton of trials to try to see if it really works. CBD, THC combinations, we just haven't done any of that research. Yeah. But when you follow people with those problems, you don't have a lot of data that support like it's doing any good for depression and anxiety. You don't necessarily have a lot of data it's doing worse, but when there's data, it tends to show that people with those types of problems don't do well if they continue to use cannabis.
Maybe a small effect. And the other complication, I mean, you got into it, you know, with THC and CBD, but my understanding is that in any given strain of cannabis, there can be upwards of 60, you know, variants of different psychoactive compounds. So, you know, who knows really what we're even studying when we're looking at, you know, uncontrolled, you know, cannabis.
Right. And so that's what this, you know, increased research with loosened laws will allow, right, is you'll allow companies or whatever, you'll be able to try to create your product. So you'll actually test a product that you know it has such and such amount of THC, such and such amount of CBD, such and such amount of CBG, and any of the compounds that they think might be somehow therapeutic or produce adverse consequences. And then if you can test that consistently in the lab or a clinic, then you have some idea. Right now, there's just all this lore out there about, oh, this combination, this ratio, it will help you with your sleep, and this ratio will help you with your pain.
And yeah,
it's labeled indica or sativa, these strains, which are original strains of cannabis. There were two types of plants. But what's being sold are these hybrid combinations of who knows what. But everybody out there that uses it regularly and that in the culture has these beliefs about which types are good for which things. And some people are doing research where they, you know, they follow people that get their drug at a dispenser, cannabis at a dispensary, and try to see if they can know what's in the product and see how they do over time.
Yeah.
But that data is pretty hairy. First, you have to be sure that they're actually, the product that's being sold has in it what they say it has in it, because
yeah, there's no regulation. Yeah.
There's no great regulation. So who knows? So it's kind of a mess that way. And that's why I kind of have a strong bias against the medical marijuana movement at this time, not medical marijuana research, but the idea that we've legalized medical marijuana and tell people that it's good for all these things, whether it's psychological or medical problems, when we have very little data except for a couple medical things. You know, I saw the other day, Pennsylvania now, you know, says you can get cannabis for your anxiety. I thought they were staying away from that in all the states, but someone said, oh, no, Pennsylvania, you can get it back. PTSD is now approved in quite a few states. Cannabis is for PTSD. And the data there, you know, again, not good. There's lots of testimony, et cetera, that PTSD can help with symptom relief. And it probably does. But is that what you want to do with your PTSD? Because if you follow your course and you're a cannabis user, again, it looks worse than if you're not a cannabis user.
Right.
But the research, there's a few trials underway where they have very specific doses of THC and CBD combinations. And I keep hearing that's going to come out any day, but still not published.
What are the medical conditions that you mentioned? There's some evidence for a few medical conditions.
Yeah, there's two forms of childhood epilepsy that they've approved CBD for, a CBD Epidiolex, which is a natural form of CBD, so it has some trace of all kinds of stuff in it, but it's basically CBD. And there was a couple multi-site trials that show it can reduce seizures and things in these kids that have failed other treatments. Other medical things, we've known for a long time, it can help, THC products can help stimulate your appetite and help you sort of with your nausea and stomach issues. So it's been approved for people with chemotherapy, who have wasting disorder, AIDS patients, et cetera. So we know it can help with those kind of things. There's other things that can help as well, but it is approved for that. And there seems to be some decent data out there for muscle spasticity disorders like MS. And there's products, there's a product that's a combination THC and CBD product that's available in multiple countries, but not in the U.S. I think the U.S. trials didn't show that much of an effect, so I believe it has not been approved. So there's some medical things that maybe people basically want to use either CBD and THC for pain. But again, we have data to show that THC can function as an analgesic, but does that mean it's a good pain medication, right?
Right.
What we want to know is, does it work better than ibuprofen, and does the effect maintain over time? And so when you read that that cannabis is good for chronic pain disorder, you know, I'd like to point out that, you know, chronic pain means chronic. It means you've had it for a long time and it stays. And so if you run just like a 6-week trial or a 4-week trial and it helps with pain, chronic pain, we want to know if it's relieving chronic pain 3 months, 6 months, and a year down the road, because tolerance is a key factor in pain management, drug use of any kind. And so the data really aren't that strong for it at this point, but, you know, it certainly can help with pain. I like to point out, like, alcohol is probably pretty good with pain too. I think we all kind of know that, but we don't say what's medical alcohol. We've got medical alcohol, right? We got past that. Alcohol does a lot of the same type of things, taking away negative pain and other medical issues.
It sounds almost like a foot in the door technique.
Well, that's what the medical marijuana movement was. It was pretty
cool. Right.
The people that did that, they said the people that got the legalization movement going, they professed that's what it was even from the beginning, which again, at this point, given that it looks like we're moving forward, my stance has been, gosh, I wish they would just come up with a legalization and get rid of the medical part and just figure out how to market it with good regulations and good policy. And if people want to use it for their, quote, medical problems, fine, just like they use alcohol. In the meantime, improve the research we have, and maybe we'll come up with some great cannabinoid medication. But right now, we don't have any.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, you... published an article called "The Importance of Psychology for Shaping Legal Cannabis Regulation." I think it was last year, maybe 2019. I'd like to hear a little bit more about that.
Sure. Well, first of all, Jake Borodovsky is the first author on that article, and he wrote most of it. He was really into that. He was a graduate student at that time, and now he got a postdoc, and he's back now working with us again as a research scientist. But anyway, got to give credit to Jake for that. That was his baby. But anyway, we've been talking about it already quite a bit. You know, when I'm talking about when the feds release cannabis and industry comes in, they know how to influence people, right? We know how to get people to buy products in this country. That's, you know, psychologists, I don't know who they hire nowadays, but when I was going through grad school, I think most of the master's and PhD students were getting hired into marketing firms because psychology knows about behavior. And you want to know what do you want to do in an industry? You want to figure out how to get people to buy your product and use your product and continue to use your product and get them to start using your product, et cetera. And so we've learned all about that now from the alcohol industry and the tobacco industries. There's a ton of research on that. And the little bit that's being done in the cannabis field just confirms that the cannabis advertising,
it's going to act the same way.
Yeah, it works the same way. Why wouldn't it? It's just some basic human behavioral principles. So we know about marketing. We know about how cost manipulations affect people's buying behavior. Mm-hmm. We know about how certain additives, you know, can change the nature of a taste. And we know that taste can make a difference in whether or not people consume more of a product. We've studied industry and we know what their behavior actually looks like. And we know how people react to certain types of advertisements. And so you can ban certain types of advertisements and only allow others. We know what types of advertisements are really marketed towards kids. And we know what kids are vulnerable to, et cetera. So all these things we've already learned about pricing and taxes, about how people respond to different types of products, different colors, you know, different smells, all those things. They all apply to the cannabis industry. And so there's a lot to take advantage of. It's still a lot of work. They haven't done necessarily such a great job with alcohol and tobacco, but they continue to chip away out of it and try to, you know, the industry's good at just moving things around. But we know that all that same stuff is important for cannabis. And that's probably one of the things that, you know, prevents the feds from just letting this go, because they know how much work it takes to get control of industry.
Yeah.
To just do it without that already in place seems awful, but I think that's how it always works in our society. You let the animal out and then you try to figure out what to do about it. You work backwards.
So smart policy would be forward thinking, would use all the data we have for cigarette smoking and drinking. And
yeah, you know, some states have enacted a lot of those policies and try to do a good job. But it takes a lot of money. You know, one of the problems with having these regulations and trying to keep big industry out of this whole thing is that to regulate a product, you got to think of all the laboratory testing that needs to happen, all the quality assurance, all the sales checks, all the monitoring of sales. All those things cost a lot of money. And so to put that burden on these small businesses can be quite taxing.
Yeah.
But if you don't, they can sell just as bad of products as the bigger industries. Or, you know, they also want to make money, and so it's kind of a tricky situation.
Yeah, I think that's a tough position to be in, right? Like, so if we take the aerial view of the cannabis literature as to date, right? Like, we know that cannabis laws have been used to over police. Right, communities of color and specifically jail young black men historically.
Right.
Depending on where you're at in the country, other people of color, like individual, like Hispanic communities and things like that in the Southwest and things like this. And so the changing of that would be monumental, right, for that reason. And then we look at why people are pushing legislation oftentimes. This rarely has to do with that, unless you're talking to somebody like Carl Hart or something like this. Usually they're talking about medical treatment related cannabis stuff. And right now the data doesn't really support anything but a few conditions that are medical in nature, like epilepsy for children and some appetite related and nausea related kind of side effects of chemotherapy and stuff. And so you kind of had these two things kind of, you know, in the discourse around legalization, and that, that we need really need to think about how to regulate these things before we just kind of let the horse out of the barn, if you will, because there's going to be all this extra side effects of right. cannabis legalization outside of, you know, just trying not to, to jail young Black men, which I think is an important primary effect of legalization.
Yeah, it's a very, very important effect. But I've struggled with that at times, because I'm always wondering, like, but you don't, you know, it's also not good for them. And so the problem with drugs, cannabis included, is the disadvantaged are more affected by them than the advantaged. And so you don't want to give the message and make it more lax, because they bear the brunt, not just legally, but they don't have as much opportunity. And so if they are high more often, heck with the legal part, you don't function as well. And if you're already behind the eight ball because of lack of good education, racial prejudice, etc., you can't let those kind of things get in the way. Somebody who's white and privileged, you know, they've got all kinds of connections, etc., they've got the educational breed, they can get high and screw up or whatever, and they get a pass. So at the same time, you don't want to act like cannabis can't become a problem for you, because like all drugs, it can. So the prevention message has to fight back against this medical message at the same time, right? Oh, it's good for your anxiety. It's good. Everybody has anxiety and depression, right? Or your pain. So if you add those three together, that's everybody. And you're telling them it's good for that. And so, again, more reason for someone to say, why not? And, you know, for a good chunk of the people, it won't be problematic. But for those that are vulnerable, we need to have some things in place to try to reduce that probability. And my field is always, you know, my research has always been development of interventions for people that do want to quit, to get themselves in trouble. And so, you know, we have treatments just like for alcohol and cocaine and cigarettes that, that quote, work. They don't work that well. So we're always leaving a lot of people behind. So we need to continue to work hard to figure out how can we help people quit marijuana if they get themselves in trouble and can't seem to quit on their own.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, this has been really a thought-provoking, and, you know, it's clear that there's no easy, I guess, answer to these questions about whether or not or how. The main message that I've gotten out of this so far is essentially that whatever happens, that it needs to be well-regulated, and we need to be psychologists should be included in the conversation to help make sure that the regulation is as good as possible.
Yeah. Agreed.
Yeah. Well, we always like to ask people come on to sort of deliver a take-home message for different stakeholder populations. Okay. What do you think the take-home message is for people who are currently in recovery?
Recovery from cannabis or other drugs?
Right, right. Well,
from cannabis.
As it applies.
okay, well, because it's a very interesting question, you know, for not just for people that quote are in recovery from cannabis, but it could be people that are no longer drinking and wondering whether cannabis is okay, because there's plenty of that going on. It always has been the case where cannabis is seen as a non-drug in some drug-using
populations.
So watch out. You know, the question is watch out. It's a drug just like any other drug, and the more potent forms are more likely to jump up and bite you than the less potent forms. Don't believe people if they say you can't get addicted. There's been a withdrawal syndrome, which has been in my research, that shows that, you know, if you use it regularly, you're going to experience withdrawal, which doesn't necessarily mean that much, but it functions just like other drugs. And so, you know, same message you have for people in recovery from any other drug. Find other things to do, to have fun, other ways to cope with your life. And God bless you if you're staying clean for long periods of time, because it's not easy. It's not easy for cannabis. maybe even harder for cannabis because people think it's not as harmful as other drugs.
Mm-hmm. What would you say to practitioners that are listening?
Take cannabis seriously. Read up on it. I mean, it's very complicated because if you're just a general, if you're a clinical psychologist or a social worker, whatever you are, that you treat mental health disorders generally, you know, a good chunk of them are using cannabis. And a good chunk of them that are using cannabis think it's helping the problem they have, if it's a mental health problem, or they might think it's help. And so you have to come up with some good strategies for how you're going to deal with that. And knowing the data helps, doesn't make you a good clinician, but it helps you try to think of what perspective to try to bring out. But it's tricky. And so you want to practice, you want to get some consultation. But don't buy the hype that it's good for these disorders. But I also always remind people, everybody's different. So I'm not going to bet that there's not some people that cannabis does not work for their anxiety disorder, right? Because that's the way things work. There's a couple people out there that this does that, this, that some drug does something for them that it doesn't do to the rest of the population. But anyway, treat the person as an individual. Recognize they can develop serious problems with cannabis. Cannabis impacts, you know, their other mental health problems in a positive way and a negative way. And you got to help them figure out the best way forward. Mm-hmm.
The whole conversation has sort of been around this, but what would you say to policymakers?
You know, look to science. We've not looked to science for a while, but, you know, science has a lot to offer, not just science in the drug abuse field, but the behavioral choice field. And what we know about alcohol and tobacco applies to cannabis. And so don't let people fool you that, oh, it's cannabis, so we should have different types of regulations on taxes would work differently, et cetera. But just know that people get in trouble with them. The addictive potential is there. We need prevention. So all the things you wanted to put in place for tobacco and alcohol, you want to get in place for cannabis.
What would you say to underserved populations that might be listening?
Underserved, well, it depends what angle we're taking. Underserved people are unfortunately vulnerable to drugs more so than people that are advantaged because they have more stress in their life and drugs can be more attractive. Everybody's vulnerable to using drugs, including cannabis, and they do provide some relief. And used in moderation in small amounts, you know, just like alcohol, et cetera, can be harmless and can be okay, maybe even stress reducing, but you got to be very, very careful and that it creeps up on you. And if you have multiple problems in your life and you find you start to use it for more and more things to help sleep, help reduce stress, get going in the morning, that's a sign it's going in the wrong direction. Watch out again, be very cautious and recognize cannabis as a drug potentially develop into a problem.
Well, Alan, thank you so much. One last question for you. You've been really successful throughout your career. And do you have any advice for the newcomers?
Newcomers? What should they do to be successful? Or they?
Yeah. For the trainees out there listening.
You still have time.
Whatever advice you.
Yeah.
Advice. Well, you know, there's two pieces to this. We're, Division 50 is a clinical division. It's not actually, not everybody's a researcher. So, you know, my advice for being successful is, you know, use a lot of common sense and think rationally. Pay attention to the science, but, you know, have an open mind. Look to see who out there, you're the leaders of the field, the mentors, who seems to have a really good perspective on things and look to them for how to think about problems, how to think about your field, and then get involved, whether that's involved with your scientific organization, like you guys are putting on these podcasts and becoming a little more involved. You're not just sitting there trying to just do your research or whatever. I'm not positive of your backgrounds, but you know, getting involved in these things makes you feel part of something. So you don't have all your apples and feeling good whether you got the grant or not, but you actually feel like you're doing some good and being helpful and providing service. But it also helps you develop connections. And it shows people you have, you're motivated to reach out and do things and offer your time. And so I always tell people, you know, show up. Show up for lots of things. Don't sit back there, because there's lots of people, unless you're like really the smartest person in your group, there's only one or two of them. So then there's all these other people that have to be successful. And you're thinking like, well, what makes them successful? And a lot of times it's connections. It's getting involved, and it's kind of learning what drives the field. And it opens up more opportunities. And people help you get to the next level. People help you with your grant writing. People review your grants. They all know you. They see you. And so you'd like to think everything's objective in the world, but it's not. It's, you know, it's about relationships and impressions that you make. So the more you can get involved and show you're out there to do good, I think the more likely it'll come back to benefit you.
Next time on the Addiction Psychologist podcast, for our student episode at the end of the month, we'll have Desiree Muskell. Des is a doctoral candidate in clinical psychology at Syracuse University and a pre-doctoral intern at the VA Maryland Healthcare System, University of Maryland School of Medicine Psychology Internship Consortium. She'll join us to talk about her research on chronic pain and substance use disorder. At the beginning of next month, we'll have Dr. Lorraine Collins joined us. Lorraine is an associate dean for research at the University at Buffalo and a professor in the Department of Community Health and Health Behavior at the University at Buffalo. She'll join us to talk about her research using ecological momentary assessment to study cannabis use.